This week on Making Contact.
Education is arguably the most important public good.
What you have is schools swamped by the inequality that exists all around them.
State budgets are strapped and deep cuts to public programs continue. And no system, perhaps, is on the chopping block more than public education. University administrators are turning to the private sector. President Obama is pushing public schools to race to the top. But teachers, parents, and students are resisting budget cuts from the bottom up.
We have a 32% fee increase that we want immediately repealed.
On this special one-hour edition of Making Contact, we'll hear who bears the burden of budget cuts to education and the driving forces behind them. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Big budget problems continue to take a toll on local schools.
$480 million in cuts to education.
$731 million from grades K through 12.
May it be too big to fix?
Teachers! No school!
Furloughed Georgia school teachers spent part of their day.
Good programs like music, art, physical education.
Our children are put dead last. Our future's at stake.
The question I have to ask you is who's going to save our children?
These are such draconian cuts, it will take us years to overcome them.
Lately, it seems almost no state is safe from budget cuts to K through 12 education. We went to Hawaii, Michigan, and California to hear from those directly affected. Just one day after the March 4th action to defend public education, a group of teachers and former teachers started what they call a March for California's Future. The group wants a tax system that favors public services over tax cuts to corporations and millionaires. During their six-week walk through California's Central Valley, teachers asked people to sign a petition to overturn the two-thirds majority vote required to pass a state budget. Reporter Emily Wilson caught up with the marchers in Stockton.
I'm David Lyle. I'm a substitute teacher with Los Angeles Unified School District, and I'm participating in the march to try to restore a little democracy into California. It disgusts me that we have such a large economy and we're 47th in the nation in per pupil spending. And I think the budget cuts have really had an impact where I've been teaching because I've seen just large class sizes. Some of the class sizes, I'm a K through 5 substitute and some of them will be up to 30 kids, which is just huge. And then I have colleagues who substitute in middle and high school, and their class sizes are even bigger. It's been a really positive experience from people we've encountered while on the march. Most people have been really supportive. I've been overwhelmed. I knew some people would honk and, you know, say hello. I didn't think people would stop, pull over, offer us fruit, give us money, shake our hands, offer us to come to their place. And that's what's happening. People have been stopping us and they tell, just it's a continual refrain. Yeah, my brother works in a school and he was just laid off, or these are some of his difficulties. And I feel like the public is on our side, that they want more funding for education.
That was David Lyle, a substitute teacher in Los Angeles, during the March for California's Future, which ended in April 2010. And now we go to Hawaii, where the school year is currently the shortest in the nation. Since October 2009, K through 12 schools have been closed every Friday. But in early April 2010, a group of parents called Save Our Schools decided they couldn't stand idly by, literally. So they staged a sit-in at Governor Linda Lingle's office demanding that she take stronger action to bring back the five-day school week. Travis Quezon and Ikaika Hussey from the Hawaii Independent sat down with one of the Save Our Schools parents on the second day of the sit-in.
My name is Marguerite Higa. I'm a parent of a third grader at Noelani Elementary School. She's a wonderful child, and she loves school.
Oh my gosh,
One of the things that really drove us to form was that nobody was representing the voices of children in Hawaii. Everybody is treating this whole situation solely as a labor negotiation. So, no, we are specifically here to tell people, don't forget about the kids.
Parents and kids are concerned the governor hasn't taken a direct role in the...
This Furlough Friday situation has just really compressed the time frame that students have to work with. And so if a school is already falling behind on the No Child Left Behind standards, what are their options? They have to drop entire subject areas. The Furlough Fridays have been a huge cut to public services to the most vulnerable citizens of our state, those that can't vote and that can't speak for themselves.
Marguerite Higa was arrested on April 14th, ending the eight-day-long parent-led occupation of the governor's office. A few weeks later, Hawaii lawmakers approved a bill to use hurricane relief funds to keep the schools open 5 days a week starting next year. In Detroit, Michigan, school closures are being touted as the answer to budget shortfalls and declining enrollment. Other districts in Michigan are facing similar challenges. We talked to a parent in Ypsilanti, Michigan, just outside of Detroit, about how folks are banding together to defend public education.
My name's Naomi Spencer. I'm 32. I live in Ypsilanti, Michigan. I'm a single mom, and I have been involved in organizing opposition to school cuts and attacks on public education. In December, the Ypsilanti School Board had to issue its own deficit elimination plan to the state in order to continue to receive funding. And its major proposals were to close two schools, to lay off as many as a third of Ypsilanti's teachers, and many other really drastic cuts. When I first heard about the school closings, I was distressed. I was disturbed that the entire school district was basically chopping its own feet off. How can a school district continue to run and serve the population when you cut such a huge proportion of teachers, when you cut such programs that are really fundamental? They're not extras. When I look at the effect that a school closing has on my own children and on their friends, you know, I'm poor. Most of my neighborhood is poor. We depend on a community school that's near us. And if you close that school, you're very negatively impacting people's already complicated lives. We held an emergency meeting of the parents at one school, and we decided that we would hold our own public meeting to independently review and analyze the budget proposal. And when we held this meeting, around 100 people showed up. We explicitly appealed to teachers and to staff workers to please show up. We wanted as broad a community input as possible. And the teachers and the staff workers really responded. The bus drivers in particular were very helpful in organizing because they would themselves take a leaflet, redistribute it. You know, a bus driver sees every parent every single day. It's sort of a natural that we organize together. I think it's absolutely critical that parents and teachers and support staff workers unite together to oppose the cuts, because so many times in the past, groups have been encouraged to defend their own small square. And all of this has resulted in isolation of the different groups. And actually, it exposes them to attacks. It makes it easier to attack unless you link it up with the fights and the struggles that other people are facing. I think that in Ypsilanti, we've seen two schools close in the last couple of years. Two more schools are going to close at the end of this school year. What is going to be left? You know, if we don't stand up and fight, nothing is going to be left.
That was Naomi Spencer, a parent organizer in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Districts in more than a dozen states have cut back to a four-day school week. Some rural districts are dealt a double financial blow from the state cuts and declining enrollment. While some parents are eager to end furloughs, one small town in Northern California has come up with creative ways to make use of their newfound free time. From Mendocino County, Christina Honestad has more.
The Potter Valley Community School District is so small, students from kindergarten to 12th grade are taught on the same campus.
In 1995, we had 165 students in our high school. At this point, we're down to 88 students in our high school. So, you know, we're half the size we used to be.
Scott Pollan grew up in this small farming town 3 hours north of San Francisco. He taught school here for 11 years and is now the principal for both the elementary and high schools. He says the population of high school kids in this rural community is steadily declining. New families just aren't moving in.
Fact of life is if you're just starting out and you have children and you're in an entry-level job somewhere, it's very difficult to move to a place like Potter Valley. There's a finite number of rentals available, and to buy a house is very difficult. As opposed to back in the 80s when you had a mill that brought people in, there was mill housing, and there were a lot more families here.
Declining enrollment means declining funds for this small school district. Pollan says because the Potter Valley High School is funded for being a small school by the state, if they have one less student next year, they get $100,000 less money. So this year the high school condensed all academic classes into 4 days of instruction instead of five. The move has allowed the school to offer more for less.
And an e-note.
On Fridays, high school students choose to either take a day off or participate in elective classes, like the new class in rock music.
Okay, now that piano I think is a little out of tune. Let's see about that. So
Keith Canova is a music teacher.
They don't have much experience. I mean, these guys haven't had lessons, but I'm going to instruct them individually.
All right, here we go.
Grants help pay for the new rock music class and for Canova to spend a few hours a week with students.
And I think this is great. I mean, this is something, I wish I had this in high school, where we had a rock band class. I certainly would have signed up. There's been a lot of interest in this class.
Pollan says because of declining enrollment, the school couldn't provide electives like music until they had a four-day school week. The district collaborated with the local community center to seek out the grants to pay for the furlough day activities. The process of deciding on the electives comes from many stakeholders. A fifth day coordinator keeps her eye out for community members with skills to share. The principal has the final say, but collects feedback from parents and students as well. One parent thought teenagers should know how to fix their own cars.
Of course, you're going to want to check the oil in the engine. So by pulling the dipstick, you look at the oil on the dipstick.
Parent Kevin Parancini volunteers his time teaching auto shop and 4-H.
I like to teach the kids. It's a good thing then to know. I was kind of hoping to have a few more girls and some of the younger kids, they probably wouldn't be so inclined to get there, but you know, later on in life with a little bit of knowledge, you know, it's possibly they can fix their own cars or at least know what somebody's talking about when they're talking to them about their car getting repaired.
While all the high schoolers get full Friday furloughs, the younger students get a half day. The Friday electives are sponsored by the Potter Valley Youth and Community Center. Maria Johnson is the center's coordinator.
It's our community and our kids, so we wanted to help.
Potter Valley's one in about 120 schools in the country that runs on a four-day week, mostly because of financial strains. That's according to District Principal Pollan. He says the school district studied the idea for 2 years before implementing the shorter week.
But the concept of the four-day week really got its start back in the 70s during the energy crisis, and a number of schools throughout the western United States went to a four-day week in order to save money. If you shut your school down for a day, you save a lot of transportation costs, heating and cooling, and things like that.
Aside from being a cost-saving measure, Pollan says furlough days were a good way to introduce elective classes. The school then presented the concept to parents before implementing the shorter week.
Instead of just trying to address a budget shortfall by cutting, we said, well, how could you restructure your entire school so that you could still accomplish the rigorous course of study for college prep and yet bring back more of the arts and electives for our kids?
Pollan says other advantages include fewer absentee days from staff and students, fewer discipline problems, and higher morale. So far, the response from parents has been mostly favorable. Lisa Oden has three children at Potter Valley.
They have an excellent after-school program. I love this school. It's fantastic. I think for high schoolers it will work. I think it's a very long day for them, though. My daughter takes a high school class. She's a junior higher. She takes a high school class on Mondays, and she's exhausted on Monday night. I think for a small rural district, though, there aren't a lot of options, and we want to keep this school open.
Fewer days does not mean fewer hours of instruction, however. For the younger kids, a shortened Friday means longer school days the rest of the week, and that has some parents concerned. Amy Silva has two children and says her kids are gone from 6:30 in the morning to 5:30 at night.
I just think it's too long for the kids, you know, that I don't think they get much sleep, but they, you know, they have homework when they get home, and they just have trouble.
Other high school students are taking community college classes on their day off. Meredith Randall is vice president of education and student services at Mendocino Community College.
In fact, we do have more than one student who has simultaneously graduated from high school and actually come here first and gotten their two-year degree, and then a month later get their high school diploma. That is possible to do that if they're very motivated.
But the Potter Valley Community School District hasn't figured out a permanent solution. The district has to meet state standards and test scores 5 years from now. If they don't, they're back onto a five-day week. But overall, says Pollen, the move has been a positive one for this small-town community seeking to maintain local control of their youth's education.
That's sort of the driving force behind restructuring our school was we looked at it as a community and said we can either sit here and slowly watch this thing die, or we can do something about it and bring our whole community together around the school. School's kind of the focal point of the community in Potter Valley. So it's exciting to me to see sort of a rebirth of that community spirit in helping our school out.
In anticipation of another budget gap next year, the Potter Valley School Board voted in April of 2010 to give the entire school district a 4.5-day school week. This would give the district more funding. And with parents and community members willing to become active in their children's education, the new electives will stay. For Making Contact, I'm Christina Onnested in Mendocino County, California.
We'll be right back. So we've heard about the cuts to K-12 education and about how people are trying to rise above them. But what about the roots of the budget crisis? What are the policies that have forced schools to make such difficult cutbacks to education? To get some perspective, Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer spoke with an editor at the magazine Rethinking Schools.
Joining us now is Stan Karp. He's an editor of the magazine Rethinking Schools. And Stan recently wrote an article for the magazine titled School Reform We Can't Believe In. Stan, welcome to Making Contact.
Thank you.
So right now, we have tens of thousands of teachers being laid off, class sizes increasing, schools are being closed. Is this simply about a lack of money, or is there a structural problem that's enabled this really dismal reality?
Well, actually, probably a combination of both. Underfunding of public education is an endemic problem. There was a famous court case back in the early 70s that took the issue of educational inequality to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said while there was certainly a lot of inequality, it was not a federal issue because education is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, and it became a state-by-state issue as to how the 50 states were going to fund public education. And in most states, the systems are very inadequate. to the needs of public school children and the needs of what kind of resources are necessary to deliver quality education. And there's also a lot of inequities, so that we not only don't provide enough resources to all schools, but we provide better resources to some kids than others. And the current economic crisis is simply exacerbated that. As a matter of fact, if it wasn't for last year's stimulus bill, several hundred thousand teachers would have lost their jobs last year. And now we're coming around to the same kind of budget situation without federal stimulus funds. And so the chickens are coming home to roost in a very, you know, serious way.
What about President Obama's Race to the Top program? Right now, states are competing for federal money for schools. Do you think this is the answer, or even part of the answer, to the budget crisis?
No, it's no answer to any of our problems in public education. One of the things that has happened is that the Obama administration has actually built on the test, punish, and privatize approach of the Bush era to kind of continue policies in this direction. For example, all the new money that the federal government wants to give to education this year, in Race to the Top and related programs, it wants to distribute as competitive grants to states with winners and losers. In the past, Title I funding had always been distributed on the basis of need, where it was used to support kids who were born in poverty or kids who had educational disabilities or language learning issues, but they were distributed on a categorical basis, on the basis of need. Instead, the Obama administration is using this competitive grant process to distribute funds to winners who agree to implement the administration's particular policy reforms, such as increasing the number of charter schools or using test scores to make decisions about teacher compensation or promotion or tenure. And these are the kinds of decisions that actually erode public education, erode the role that teachers and educators have in making decisions, and actually will hurt poor schools who can't write grants, who are in a worse position to actually compete competitively for federal funds. Somebody compared it to having the unemployed duke it out over unemployment benefits. Turning federal funding into competitive grants to support privatized reforms is not the kind of equity and access support that we should be getting from the federal government in this area.
And you write in your article in Rethinking Schools that the Race to the Top has resulted in, I'll quote you here, aggressive intervention for schools with low test scores, including closures, firing of staff, and various forms of state and private takeovers. You just talked about that a little bit, but can you give some examples?
Right. One of the things that happened under No Child Left Behind is that schools were identified as being in various degrees of sanction. And what Race to the Top is doing is actually defining those sanctions in a very targeted way that could have a dramatic impact. President Obama's Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, who was the CEO, as he called himself, of Chicago schools and comes from the kind of corporate business model of reform, was in favor of what he called turnarounds. And what this means is that all the federal money in the stimulus funding, in the new Title I, and if No Child Left Behind gets reauthorized in that act, the administration wants to tie to certain assurances that it will be used for things like closing down schools with low test scores. You might have remembered there was a school in Rhode Island that fired all the teachers at Central Falls High School because it had low test scores. And the president went out of his way to say that this was a courageous act that was right for kids, a model of accountability, and typical of what the administration wanted to repeat in thousands of schools over the next few years. Secretary Duncan has been talking about closing down 1,000 schools a year as if he was the CEO of a runaway multinational. But what they don't mention is that the federal mandates under which they close these down require the firing of staff, the firing of principals, the turning over of these schools to private management firms, or turning them over to charters. And in places, especially where there are clusters of these poor schools, it creates real havoc where schools and communities are displaced from current schools, which despite their problems are still important institutions in the community, and often replaced by schools that are serving very different sectors of the population and that are displacing large numbers of students without providing good alternatives. And this kind of disruption, which the federal government has no track record and no resources to really do well, is in fact just opening opportunities for private penetration, private operation, private management of public institutions in a very disruptive way, especially in poor communities.
So overall, big picture, you also compare the public education system in a way to single-payer health care, and you say that President Obama is treating both in similar ways. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, when he was a candidate, he would often say that if he was starting from scratch, he would favor single-payer health care, with government regulating a nonprofit system and providing access to health care for all. But he specifically said the reason he wouldn't press for that in the area of health is because it would be too disruptive to the kind of system we have in place, which was based on employer care, employer-provided care. Yet it was interesting that when it comes to education, a single-payer system is pretty much what public education is. The government is responsible for providing public access to a nonprofit system of schools for all children. The state and the local governments provide the oversight and the funding, and the federal government historically has been responsible for issues of equity and access, you know, school integration, funding for poor schools, things like that. But now in the field of education, instead of sustaining this hard-won public system, which took a long and a painful struggle to build, and to address its many flaws and improve it, instead, Obama and Duncan are proposing policies that are going to dramatically disrupt the system we have and introduce some of the same profiteering and inequities of the current healthcare system into education. And so it's very striking to see the difference in the two areas.
So what do you see as the answer to current school funding woes? What should we be doing?
Well, the federal government first, if it's going to, you know, in this climate have federal funding increase, it has to tie federal funding to a more equitable distribution of it in the states. It has to leverage the federal funds, which, because of the budget crisis, are more important than ever. It has to use that leverage to encourage states and reward states for improving the equity and adequacy of their own state finance systems. It also has to stop promoting privatization and merit pay and things which really erode the ability of teachers to make educational decisions. So there's a real chance to have a change in federal direction and the direction of federal policy, but it's going to take a huge push from the bottom in order to change the direction that we're now going in.
Stan Karp is an editor at Rethinking Schools magazine. Stan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer spoke with an editor at the magazine Rethinking Schools. The University of California is known around the world as one of the most successful models of publicly funded higher education. In 1960, UC President Clark Kerr spearheaded the groundbreaking California Master Plan for Higher Education, seeking to make quality education accessible to all.
The university is being called upon to educate previously unimagined numbers of students, to respond to the expanding claims of national service.
Yet some 50 years later, some say the foundation of public education is being dismantled through fee hikes, layoffs, and corporate funding. Making Contact's Pauline Bartoloni has more about folks who are opposing the corporate takeover of what was meant to be a public good.
When the massive 32% UC education fee increase was posed during summer break 2009, the fall semester started off with a bang. All 10 UC campuses staged a walkout. At Berkeley, thousands rallied on the campus's main sprawl plaza, spilling into the streets. And that was just the inaugural event. Students organized in preparation for the November Board of Regents meeting, when they'd be voting on the fees. Sociology PhD candidate Zachary Levinson was one of them.
God, I feel like I've never been in that many meetings in my life. It was hard to keep up academically. I barely slept, but it was fantastic. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this on an American campus.
For the 3 days the board planned to meet to approve the fee hikes, students and faculty planned another walkout in protest. But this time, the turnout was lower than they had hoped.
On September 24th, we had 5,000 people come out. So we were pretty anxious to see what the turnout was going to be. We assumed, of course, it would be larger. It was a huge turnout. It was fantastic. But I can't say that the organizers weren't a bit disappointed. I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone else. I guess myself, I was a bit taken aback to see that after that much effort, 2,000 people come out.
The Board of Regents approved the fee hikes. Students in L.A. had it out with riot cops, and others occupied a campus building. So Levinson and over 100 people at Berkeley met to talk about their response.
As a body, we decided that escalation was necessary. I mean, overwhelmingly, people supported some form of direct action. So yeah, 43 of us ended up going inside Wheeler and locked the building down and occupied it.
Levinson and dozens of others blocked the doors inside Wheeler with chairs and waited for classes to begin. In a video documenting the occupation, the protesters are shown hanging banners from windows and speaking to people on the outside with bullhorns.
We have a 32% fee increase that we want immediately repealed. But you know what? We want a whole lot more than that. We want public education that is free. We want transparency and we want democracy. We want to democratize the region.
You could say it was a spontaneously organized action. Some folks inside didn't even know each other. They texted and called their friends to get them to come out for support and surround the building. And they did. All in all, they were in Wheeler for less than 24 hours, and none of their demands were met. But to them, it was a success. It meant a new stage in the movement. But these folks weren't just protesting a more expensive education. There was something much larger that the students were fighting for. Levinson, as a PhD candidate, will come out of the fee hikes unscathed. He took the risk at Wheeler on principle.
Education is arguably the most important public good. In addition to, of course, meeting kind of bare necessities and, you know, shelter and food and water and maybe this is a sociologist in me speaking or something, but if you look at any stratification research, I mean, again and again, the most important variable influencing class reproduction is education. And so as soon as you close off public education, or any education for that matter, to a massive segment of the population, namely the working class, elements of the middle class even, and students of color, you shut them out of a certain kind of class reproduction process, where these people are then excluded from a certain type of job, a certain type of white-collar position that I think a prestigious university like any university in the UC system allows you to obtain.
Levinson says he was protesting a trend that is changing the nature of public education in the U.S., a change enabled by the economics of the times.
We basically see the privatization of public education. These individuals, high up in the administration, have been using this financial crisis, which of course no one's going to deny, no one's going to say this crisis isn't real, but they've been using this crisis to force through an agenda of the privatization of public education. So this has amounted to, you know, mass layoffs, basically austerity measures. People who talk about structural adjustment imposed by the IMF and the World Bank in the 1980s and 90s as something happening over there, you know, something in Africa or Latin America. It's happening here, and we see it in California, and it's not just California. We see it, it's happening in the University of Illinois system, the University of North Carolina system. Talk to people organizing at Georgia State. I mean, the same thing's happening all over the U.S.
Levinson and others say the problem is not just a lack of funding from the state. They're concerned the UC system will use the fee hikes to back construction projects, not instruction. But university officials tell a different story. After the Regents meeting in November, UC President Mark Udoff is shown in a video surrounded by media. He frames the decision to raise fees as something that they had no choice but to do.
Is there any way to avoid the fee increase for students? I don't think so. We're down over $1 billion. The state's down another $20 billion. We've cut people's pay. We have laid off 2,000 workers. We have shut down libraries, at least we don't do the late hours. We have reduced our supplies, our travel. I'm sorry. I mean, this is a situation where the students' rightful expectations just exceed the resources of the University of California.
Udoff says students from families who make less than $70,000 a year will not be affected by the fee hikes. And he pointed fingers at lawmakers in Sacramento.
You know, the problem is the master plan is sort of in tatters at the moment. I mean, it was a great plan. The students paid basically nothing to attend the university, high-quality education, research university, a big chunk of poor kids, always at least a third. And the plan's still a good plan. It's the execution in Sacramento that's the problem.
But some faculty don't see the problem as just a financial one. Laura Nader has been a professor at UC Berkeley for nearly 50 years. She sees a crisis of priorities.
Well, every time they want to change something in this country, the powers that be call it a crisis. If it's a crisis, it suggests that it's just beginning to happen and they have to do something about it quick. But we have the regents of the university for a purpose. They're supposed to see ahead and take care of the university, but they haven't been doing that.
Crisis mode is useful for government and corporations. Serves as a justification for shifting gears.
Nader's been active in the movement against the fee hikes. She spoke at a teach-in at the UC Berkeley campus about the budget crisis. She says there's been a trend towards privatizing the university for decades.
My husband graduated from this university in 1952. His fees were $28 a semester. And it did increase little by little. But then big changes started to happen in the late 80s, maybe earlier in the 90s. What it means is that you value knowledge on the basis of bottom line. You start to give more money to certain parts of the campus than others. You start to not build a natural history museum, but you build stem cell buildings here on the campus, whereas at UCSF they already have several buildings doing stem cell. You start to repeat why, bottom line. British Petroleum came in with $500 million. They didn't look at the consequences. They didn't look at whether we needed biofuels more than good transportation systems, or they just took it because it was money. They say, this is the bottom line, Laura, what do you mean? $500 million, you're going to turn that down? You're going to look at the consequences, I say. Your people are like dogs in heat. They see the money and they go for it.
Bob Meister is a professor at UC Santa Cruz and served on the University of California System-Wide Committee on Planning and Budget. He says a fee increase is part of a trend in debt-financed education. More debt, he says, will mean fewer people will be able to come out ahead.
What the university is doing now is no longer offering you an opportunity to get a higher education and improve your own life and conditions with no risk. It's asking you to assume a fixed financial risk upfront in an economy where the benefits of getting a higher education are very uncertain, but where your willingness to take that risk is going to make you keep on paying for a long part of your life for the choice you make now. President Udoff is trying to suggest that we're merely followers, and this is happening everywhere. In fact, you see fee hikes, especially over the past decade, and especially under Governor Schwarzenegger, have been much greater than elsewhere. So we're actually leaders in the trend toward privatization. And these tuition hikes are going to make UC fall rapidly relative to a great many other publics.
We will win, but it's going to take a while. I mean, this could take a couple of years. First and foremost, this is a two-front war, and, you know, we could solve the problems in Sacramento, and it wouldn't solve a damn thing. I mean, if UCOP and the regents are using budget shortfall coming from Sacramento as an excuse to privatize the university, I don't think solving the crisis in Sacramento is going to solve the thing.
Laura Nader says preserving public education requires good leadership, and a healthy democracy needs education that's affordable and accessible.
Is education a public good necessary for an informed people in a democracy, or is it a private good for the elite? This goes back to Jefferson. So it's a fight worth fighting, because I think it has a lot to do with the quality of a democracy. If you have uninformed citizens, you're not going to have a very good democracy. You're going to have a weak democracy. We're trying to spread democracy around the world. You have to be one to spread it. So here we are at a time when the empire part of the United States is being discussed and criticized worldwide. The only good things we have, we're destroying. It's like we're eating ourselves. Why would you destroy the one thing that the world thinks is the greatest thing we've got?
For Making Contact, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We'll be right back. Like other states across the country, Oregon is struggling with the question of how to fund higher education in a time of shrinking budgets. Portland State University, or PSU, has increased class sizes and made deep cuts to student programs and teacher pay. But recently, PSU's president proposed a new model to solve the university's budget woes, incorporation. From station KBOO, Jenka Soderberg has more.
Portland State University is a bustling urban campus located in downtown Portland, Oregon. The students here are mainly a commuter population, and the campus is hardly a hotbed of student activism. But when University President Vim Vivel went public with his proposal to address the university's budget woes, students started organizing to oppose what they call a privatization scheme.
We have the power!
We have the power!
President Vivel's restructuring plan has two major components: call on the state to set minimum funding requirements for all public universities, and turn the university into a public corporation. The latter is what's rocking the boat. At a rally outside the student union one Friday afternoon, more than 75 students gathered to say no to the proposed restructuring. Student Wael El-Assadi was one of the organizers of the protest.
This is not a solution for the financial challenges facing our higher education. We do not need a Wall Street exotic formula of leveraging debt enacted by an unaccountable board of directors to fix our education system.
But President Vivel stands firm. Over the last 20 years, public funding for higher ed in Oregon has dropped 44%, while public safety and prison spending has gone up by 50%. The result? Increased tuition costs by almost a quarter for each student. Vivel says drastic times need drastic measures and believes incorporation is the only way to ensure a stable funding base for PSU. But Jonathan Sanford, PSU's student body president, sees it another way.
Why isn't he going to D.C. and saying, damn it, we need more teachers in our classrooms. Damn it, we need to pay our teachers more. Damn it, our students need to have enough funding.
President Vivel cites Oregon Health and Science University as a success story. OHSU incorporated 15 years ago. This year, it's facing a $30 million budget shortfall, and students are certain to pick up the remaining tab. PSU students worry the same will happen to them. But Oregon State Board of Higher Education Vice President Jim Francesconi says students and opponents of privatizing don't have to worry.
I think it's fair to say that the university president would like the ability to raise tuition. And we haven't yet decided how that's going to work out. I suspect that there will be some guidelines placed upon it, if not by the legislature, by the board. But it's an issue that needs a lot of discussion with the students, with the faculty, with all the stakeholders, and then eventually by the legislature and the board.
Right now, Oregon's public universities are bound to state-legislated tuition caps. PSU in-state students pay $6,400 a year in tuition and fees. Without those state caps, they say shortfalls in funding are sure to hit their pocketbooks. But they say it's not entirely about the money. Students say incorporating PSU will also change its overall character and mission. Opening its doors in 1945, Portland State University's origins are rooted in the city's black community. Catering at first to World War II vets, it quickly gained a reputation as the People's University within the Oregon State University system, and was known for its open admission process and inclusion of minority communities. Student activists like Zaki Bucharest worry incorporating will change that.
As far as I'm concerned, when you allow an institution to fall between the cracks of financial stress to the point of restructuring is nothing but an acknowledgement of a high level of financial mismanagement. The continual system of accruing debt and credit lines and requests for debt forgiveness has been allowing administration of universities, including our own, to follow up in cleaning house for specialty programs. Cleaning houses and kicking them out and consolidating them, such as Black Studies, Chicano Latino Studies, Native American Studies, and Women's Studies, or programs that do not produce revenue for the university.
While incorporation of Oregon's state universities is one option for dealing with the budget crisis, it's not the only proposal on the table. Some administrators have brought up the possibility of turning Oregon universities into a system like the University of California, where tuition forms the main basis of funding. That way, legislators can't cap tuition as they do in Oregon. But student activists have taken a different sort of inspiration from what's happening in California. Adam Sanchez is a PSU graduate student and a primary school teacher.
We've seen the largest and the deepest cuts in California, and thankfully they've been met with one of the strongest movements to defend public education that we've seen in this country, I think, since the 1960s. But I think we have to spread that now outside of California.
Meanwhile, PSU students say they will continue to organize protests and lobby state legislators. A decision on PSU's restructuring proposal could be approved by the state legislature as early as April. If approved, PSU students and opponents of incorporation fear the university's focus will shift from quality and accountability to profitability. For Making Contact, I'm Jenka Soderberg, Portland, Oregon.
We gotta build towards that day to support the students in California, because we're facing the same cuts here. Yeah!
From raising fees to incorporating entire universities, there are many ways universities nationwide are being privatized. As we heard earlier in the show, California's public education system has been eroding for decades, and some say it's being dismantled by design. Christopher Newfield wrote a whole book about it. He's a professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara campus, and author of Unmaking the Public University, the 40-Year Assault on the Middle Class. Our producer, Tina Rubio, recently spoke with Professor Newfield.
In this show, we actually profiled a couple of different ways education is being privatized. On the face of it, privatizing our educational system might seem like a good idea to some, but in your opinion, is it?
No. The great contribution of low-cost public higher education was mass access to high quality. That was the secret formula of the University of California and in a different way of Cal State. And by that I mean that you would have a campus, you know, that is starting with Berkeley and then expanding throughout the system. where you had cutting-edge research, where you had internationally renowned scholars, you had some of the most amazing thinking, the best poets, the best scientists, et cetera, working. And then the children of farm workers and the children of factory workers would go to lectures and have those folks grading their papers. I mean, that was the vision, to have this contact between every element of society such that people that were first-generation college educated, were immigrants, were low-income, had access to the best that society had to offer. The best was not just reserved for a tiny elite. When everybody has to pay, stratification increases, and the best gets reserved for a much smaller group. You see, all around the world, there are fabulous universities for 1% or 2% of the population. The California secret was to have that for 12%, and then with Cal State for 33%, and access through the community college transfer system for 100% of people who wanted to go on after high school.
Let's talk a little bit about after graduation. So 2/3 of four-year college graduates leave with loan debt averaging about $23,000. That number is likely to increase if students can't get the courses they need to graduate on time. So we're hearing that some students might have to stay 5, maybe 6 years. What implications does that have in terms of the choices students or people will have to make after they graduate?
Well, it means that they have to take any job they can get. It means that people will move out of socially valuable but lower paying jobs like teaching and social work and nursing and move into jobs that pay more. If somebody goes to law school and they graduate with, you know, $200,000 in debt, it means they will work in corporate law firms rather than working on, you know, sexuality issues for, you know, $58,000 a year. They literally can't keep a roof over their head and pay their loans at the same time. So it's a loss to society. It's a loss to the social value that is created by people who are not as well paid as, you know, as folks in business, et cetera, but who do something that everybody needs. So I think the California public is less aware of what it gets from basically medium paid as well as low paid labor.
And what do you think would happen if this country privatized their education?
We would lower the rate of college attainment, and we would become more ignorant than we already are. We would fall behind economically. We would have more social conflict. We would have less social understanding. All these things are already happening. In California, the state fell from 5th in the nation to 47th in 8 years between 1996 and 2004. In the rate of the college continuation, that is, whether you not only start college but actually finish it, which is, of course, the crucial index of how you fare later on. We don't have an obvious direct causal connection between rising fees and that decline in educational attainment, but they did happen at the same time. There's a strong likelihood of a correlation.
Well, in light of our current cuts to higher ed taking place across the country, what potential scenarios do you see for the future?
In the short term, I think that the Obama administration is going to pour the lion's share of money into bank rescues and wars in the Middle East. So I'm not really that optimistic in the short run. The higher education leadership in California has asked for direct operating funds to come from the federal government in partnership with the states. That's not going to happen, I don't think, because the federal government is now moving towards a commitment for supporting student fees through Pell Grants and the expansion of similar programs. So I think the short term is blocked. I think the medium term people are going to have to become much more active in defining the kind of society that they want, and where education is a central part of that. There's a good, you know, grassroots network that's already was put in place by the Obama administration. There's a lot of skill out there around internet organizing and face-to-face organizing. And I think that we actually, in 2009, a major change took place, which is that for the first time in my adult lifetime, everybody figured out that cuts to public funding lower quality. People didn't know that before, and elements in UC's administration had denied that that was the case. in order to, you know, reassure contributors, both corporate and individual philanthropists, that quality was very high and they were giving money to a good thing. It's understandable that they would do that, but it misled the public. And I think finally we have the foundation for saying, look, if you want the kind of golden age that we had before, any simulacra of that, of greater social peace and understanding, greater cultural productivity and enlightenment in the old sense, and economic growth of the old kind, you have to invest in higher education for the future. My hope is that people know this now and that they're going to restore and rebuild public higher education, continue to grow it, bring in folks that are currently shut out in much higher proportions, Latinos and African Americans in California in particular, and they will get back on track. You know, we were on a good path in the 60s and 70s around these issues, and we forgot some of the gains that we made. They were incomplete, but they were good. And so I just see a lot of not return, but a kind of a reimagination of where we can go happening in the next few years.
And Chris, is there anything that I left out that you'd like to add?
I mean, here's another piece of this that I think is really important. When you have mass education, you can't get feedback and skill training in the way that you get if, say, you're trying to become a ballet dancer or a musician or a photographer. You know, if you go to art school, there's a kind of a craft relationship that is increasingly not present for undergraduates in large state universities. And what that means is that they basically have to teach themselves. And it, you know, it's much more like online education, which is good in a lot of ways, but you don't get sort of detailed hands-on instruction. That's what people get at expensive private schools. They get seminars with 10 people. They get their papers graded once a week. They get every sentence corrected if that's what they need. I want that for everybody in the society, not a fragmented society in which a small percentage gets that and everyone else just has to shift for themselves. We'll figure out how to pay for it. We can use technology to do it. But the explosion of, you know, creativity and imagination that would take place if all of this talent, or a high percentage of this talent, were not left by the side of the road would be just extraordinary and would more than pay for whatever extra money we put into it.
That was Christopher Newfield, professor at UC Santa Barbara and author of Unmaking the Public University, the 40-Year Assault on the Middle Class. He spoke with Making Contact producer Tina Rubio. And that's it for this special edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our programming for free to radio stations across the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. Thank you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio executive producer, Pauline Bartoloni is our producer and online editor, Andrew Stelzer producer, CONFAM associate director, Daphne Young station relations. Elena Daigle, Rashida Harmon, and Joaquin Palomino are interns, and Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Jen Gordon, Alton Bird, Alfonso Hooker are volunteers. And I'm Sandina Robbins. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.